give you just a little idea of how I come to where I am as a musician, and then we can go on to talk about some things that we can do with church music to inject a little variety into what happens on Sunday morning and why we should try to do that. I grew up in a family that went church shopping every time we moved into a new community. My dad was a member of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. My parents were married in the Evangelical United Brethren Church, and I would consider us to be sort of mainline evangelical, if we can use those two terms together. We did attend a Methodist church at one point, attended an independent Bible church at one point, finally ended up in another EUB church when I was in high school. During this time, I was studying piano, and I was such a bad practicer when I was in junior high school that my piano teacher threw up her hands, gave me to one of her friends who also couldn't deal with me. So they shipped me off to, I lived in Kansas City at the time, Rick Connell, who played at Pooch's side door on the plaza. And Rick Connell introduced me to what I was already doing on the piano with some of my piano music, which I shouldn't have been, which was arranging, improvising, playing modern melodies for the piano, which had such wonderful things as Prelude to a Kiss by Duke Ellington. I've been a fan of Ellington ever since. And so I had that kind of life going on while I was singing as a voice soprano, as a soloist in church from time to time. Throughout high school, I played in the orchestra, I played in the jazz band, I played piano in the jazz band, horn in the orchestra, sang in the choirs, wrote music, and went off to college. Didn't really settle into a music major until after I'd been out of school for a while and come back. For me, music was always so much fun that it didn't really feel like a vocation. So finally I figured out that, well, yeah, you have these gifts for a reason, duh. And I began to pursue music as a career, first as a teacher. All the time I was going through school, I was playing in jazz ensembles. And about the time I hit high school was the time when small town American Christians started, young ones, started to think that, well, maybe we could do some more fun music than the stuff that we do all the time. And so I can remember as a sophomore and junior in high school, I helped plan an ecumenical service with Patty Shelley, whose song, The Lord Lift You Up, was the benediction last night. Yeah, it's a great, great piece. She's a wonderful, she's a wonderful person, a wonderful theology teacher at Bethel College in Kansas, and I was going to say she was a wonderful songwriter. Well, I'm sure she still is. I just don't know her current song so well. And she's done less writing, I know, over the last several years. But I've been called on in many situations because of my experience with jazz and other kinds of popular musics to provide the function of doing that music in the church that I was in. I have been a church music director. I am not currently a church music director. I haven't been since I moved to Valparaiso. But I do enjoy playing services. Several years ago, the Augsburg Fortress asked me to do accompaniments for the Liturgy of Joy as they were getting ready to publish that in the Smart Life Faith, because the accompaniments were very sparse and really didn't help people who were classically trained musicians try to make some sense of how to give some authentic feel. So I've asked one of our wonderful church music majors from Valparaiso, Laura Potratz, who's a very talented organist, also a fine violinist and violist, and last week got a chance to play both of those, and a person who played piano in her jazz band in high school. So you played what? Very sad. So there you go. Yeah. So, but she has some sense of how to read chords and that kind of thing. And so I've asked her participate in a kind of an open lesson today. So I've given her an assignment ahead of time to prepare Amazing Grace in a couple different styles, and also to play through some of the Liturgy of Joy accompaniments, both the originals and dressed up for the non-improvising crowd, and she's graciously agreed to do that, so we'll get to that after a bit. I end up in my own church and also the Chapel of the Resurrection of Valparaiso, being the person who gets called in as the ringer to play the gospel services. And it's an interesting position also here because Trinity Lutheran in Valparaiso, John Santoro, who's a senior pastor there, did not grow up Lutheran. However, I left that out of my story. I grew up in a more evangelical tradition. And joined the Mennonite Church during the Vietnam War. I came to a point where I just could not, in good conscience, go to serve in the armed forces, although I had sort of planned to, because I was growing up, but would be convicted as a senior in high school. So that was another kind of disjunct. And I would have to say that being in the Mennonite Church for a couple of decades had a big influence on me because there's a wonderful music tradition, particularly a part singing. The church that we attended in Goshen College for, I don't know, 6-7 years. Song leader gave a pitch from a pitch pipe, and everybody opens up in four-part singing. If you've never heard it, you should go to one of those churches because it's so inspiring. And for me, this is not where I'm going at this point in the presentation, but it's going to come later. It's such a wonderful metaphor for the body, and I just have a hard time understanding where they were trying to get rid of the four-part singing, and so they replaced the four-part choral harmonizations with harmonizations that work for the keyboard but not for voices to do. So I still sing parts on Sunday morning a lot at our church when we do LBW things. And I encourage the congregation when I'm playing to sing in parts and talk a little bit about that. Actually, I might as well say now since we're on that topic. I feel like we need to, particularly in this day and age, have a variety of expressions. We can talk about the rationale for that. I think that feels like there's a question mark on that. But I think that it's an important aspect. And I think that a cappella singing requires a level of commitment from the parishioner. In the pew, that's a step above the requirement that it's what it takes to just sing along with the organ. And part of what I think we need to do for members of the pew is raise the expectation level gently of how much they're going to participate in the service, because it's clear to me that you receive from the service in proportion to that. And that healthier singing which has more. So many traditions, it's been my privilege to study, and I'm very much a dilettante in this area, I'm not at all an authority, but in studying music of other traditions, African traditions, and other American traditions, several Asian traditions, music is performed because of the effect that the performance of the music has on the person who is doing it. It is a spiritual discipline. Singing, dancing, playing the drums in a community in Africa, there is some kind of desired result. Some of it may be external in terms of rain or good harvest or something like that. Part of it is an impact on the person. The Tibetan monks who have toured the United States trying to raise money for supporting Tibet. The reason that they do the chanting is because it does something to them. And I think that Christian hymnody is in the West one of the very few places where that tradition is still in place. I think it's precious. I think it needs to be nurtured, and I think it needs to be expanded. So what I propose to do in this particular session, in the first session we looked at the Lutheran World Federation statement about worship materials and talked about the shape of the Mass. Process that happens in personal transformation that we see in rites of passage from many cultures and don't have in place very well in the United States and in Western culture. So the Mass is one of the places where we can go through those motions and from time to time it can have that kind of impact for us. So what I propose to do today is talk in a
is fine.
No, it's fine. What's going to happen is that some of the stuff will do this a little bit. They're going to be kind of technical. But I would really like for you to ask questions as we go along, because I feel like it's a place where the resource and the lecture is this gives me and Laura a chance to interact on these things, because I'm not actually in the degree program at Valparaiso. I'm in the orchestra and composition end, but not really involved in teaching church music. But in any event, I think it will be worthwhile, however, for you to be able to see some things at the keyboard, even if you're not a keyboard player. So would you grab a chair and move so that you can see, and feel free to ask questions at any time.
We have keyboard players, so just
That's fine. I'm not going to ask anybody else to play.
Okay.
And believe me, I gave Laura some notice ahead of time. But I also told her anything she didn't want to play, she didn't have to play. So some of these things I will be doing.
I always have to think, okay, basically.
Yeah, right. Let me give just a little bit more intro here. I've got my notes on too many different pages. I want to drop back to my first speech, because it may, since not so many of you are going to be actually accompanying the congregations, it may be worthwhile for me to speak just a little bit more generally. After talking about the ways the Lutheran World Federation statement talked about how worship is always local. It always happens in a specific context. So the choice of the materials need to relate to the local culture, the people in that area. And there are things about that which are transcultural, in the sense that they don't change between cultures. Everybody has the Eucharist. Everybody reads the scripture, but they read it in their own language. They may take the Eucharist with a different kind of material, but it's still the Eucharist. Okay, so there are things which are transcultural, there are things which are specific to the culture, but it's also the case, as I was kind of saying in my opening statement, that worship in the 21st century needs to be absorbing elements of the local culture and transforming, and I think they even use the word baptizing, elements of the local culture for use within the service. Ways to build bridges to the local community, both churched and unchurched, and also at times in judgment of the local culture. There are going to be some things that are not appropriate to use, and the judgments about those are part of what worship is about. I made a list of things that I thought needed to happen for music coming out of that discussion, and the first one I said was, I think that we need to select materials and also the mode of performance. And I'm going to use the word performance here a little bit broadly. I don't believe that it's often appropriate. Well, it's not appropriate for the Mass to be performed for the congregation. The congregation does it. There are times when a choir or a soloist or a special ensemble may provide some music in the course of the service, but most of it needs to be participational. But that is a performance in a generic word. So that's the reason I use the word performance. I'm not just speaking about concert music brought into the church setting. I'm talking about any time music is done, I use the word performance. And it needs to be chosen on the basis of its function in the rite. And there also needs to be enough tension for, as I said, there needs to be enough tension for people to be moved, for them to be touched. It's a place where we come to, yes, feel a part of the body of Christ. There's a certain comfortability there. There's a certain familiarity. It's also important that there be some challenges in that time. There needs to be a process, an ongoing process of growth. So that's point number one. Point number two, the variety of cultural sounds, and this partly comes from that statement, all of these elements, different tempos, different textures, we'll talk about in a bit, levels of complexity, can be used to increase the temperature, as it were, the experience of things in church. When people come up to compliment me on my piano playing for the evening service, there's part of me that goes, oh, it's not about how I play the piano, but I have to trust when they say that to me, it's about the experience that they had being the service. It's not just, wow, have you got a CD out? You know, that's not what it is. What it is, hopefully, is that there's something about the way I play that brings them in closer contact with the text of the hymn, or not necessarily with the text at all, but with a certain kind of experience of the community here. It gives them a connection to Holden Village, which I think is a sacred place. So those are things that are goals for me. So variety is important. Surprise at times. High standards of heartfelt performance. I believe that we must do church music well. We live in a world where the cheapest compact disc is better produced than the average Sunday morning service. This is tragic. I've often said 200 years ago I would have been a church musician. And as I look at the reasons why I'm not a church musician these days, some of it is there. You know, partly I was attracted, and I didn't come from a wonderful organ playing tradition like Laura does. I was attracted to music done well, with passion, with quality. And I think that it has to be done well. And the most fundamental reason is that if it's not done well, that's when it really attracts attention to the performer. Exactly. Exactly, and it pulls you out of it. There's, you know, a wonderful hymn. I don't care if it's my favorite hymn or not, you know. If we end up with B flat instead of B natural, it's like I have to start over. You know, that's not entirely true. And I make a half a dozen mistakes every service I've done. But there is a certain level, and it requires investment of time and energy, and it deserves it, and it rewards it in a wonderful way. And the fourth one was, as I said the other day, partly this is a note to myself because I like things that are interesting and complicated. I spend a lot of time learning how to understand the stuff, and I like to use it all, you know. So you've got this wonderful synthesizer. You want to be able to hear all the bells and whistles are on it. And I think the willingness to use simple materials and repetitive materials is very important. And this focuses on spirituality, and those of you who are going to experience prayer around the cross for the first time tonight will have a chance to sense the power of that. But part of what we have to do, particularly in Western culture and American culture, is get past our data-driven bottom-line orientation and get in touch with what does the heart require, what does the spirit require. It takes time. We need to take time to be with one another. We need to take time to be with ourselves. We need to take time to be with God, and simple repetitive music does that, and everybody else in the world knows it. And honestly, the younger generation knows it. All you have to do is turn on the radio. Yeah, yeah. And the thing about it is that the focus on drums, the focus on rhythm, is hard for those of us who grew up in the note orientation. You know, if you listen to the rhythm of a piece of Bach, it's really quite subtle, and we find it lovely. But you listen to the rhythm in an African piece, and if you don't know anything about it, it gets boring in a hurry because you've got the same thing going over and over. And I think to understand that, I had the pleasure of standing next to one of my older colleagues at Valparaiso at a Zydeco concert. We had two Louisiana bands came to the campus, and one of them was a Zydeco band, and Zydeco is a very rhythmic music. It's more roots-based, more African-related than Dixieland. And he enjoyed the Dixieland band more. I enjoyed the Zydeco band more. The Dixieland band used more pitch-based kind of things, sliding trombones, interesting chord changes, and that kind of stuff. And also, it was more familiar to him. The Zydeco band was much more interested in the groove. I couldn't stand still. It was just wonderful. But to him, it wasn't really very interesting. And it's because he wasn't tuned into where the rhythm was, of course. There's no accounting for taste, and everybody has their own taste. variety is because within our congregations, there are no congregations that I know of where taste is uniform, you know, all the way through the congregation. But the willingness to use simple materials to get past the rational language end of things into the heart is, I think, quite important. All right, well, we're going to go in now to a somewhat technical...
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure, go ahead.
And I'm very simple-minded in this, uneducated. I was struck by something I read by I was a pastor of a person in the church who said music has dramatically changed in the 20th century from, I think the emphasis was on complication of melody to being rhythm-driven. And that's the fundamental change in music that's driving the culture war. I'm interested in your reaction because your last thing you were talking about was maybe thinking.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And you can I can talk about that in the classical realm, maybe first, which would be with some names that are more familiar to you. If you think about why did the audience in Paris tear up the seat cushions at the premiere of The Rite of Spring? It wasn't that there were chords that they had never heard before, but it's because non-Western, and to them, barbaric. It was anti-art, as far as they could tell. Well, we now consider The Rite of Spring to be maybe the pivotal piece, and maybe even the best piece of the 20th century. It came along very early, and the rest of us are still just kind of snitching little bits and hoping nobody notices, because it's such a great piece. And part of what was happening in Paris at that time was very deliberate appropriation of materials, particularly from Africa, but also from Asia. And you can point to 87, something like that, World's Fair in Paris. The Javanese gamelan comes along, and all of a sudden the music of the film makes and changes, and that's really when the 20th century begins. And the use of African music in the African influence in American popular music. You know, once the people in New Orleans banned drum ensembles, they said you cannot have more than one Negro playing drums in one place at any one time in public. Yeah, this happened. So what they had to do was drummers would put a whole bunch of drums together. They would make a contraption of drums, which got shortened to trap set. So now you got guys who can do the whole thing themselves. It's unbelievable. I have sometimes wished I were a drummer, but I didn't have enough discipline for that. But one of the things that I'm going to do today is show you how the sort of fundamental bell rhythm of Western Africa permeates the music of the New World, which would be in the category that we call popular. We draw popular as broadly as we can. Tin Pan Alley, a lot of show tunes, certainly rock and roll, which in many ways was a return to the roots, a simplification in some ways, or I should say maybe rhythmicization, focus more on rhythm than on notes. And this finally came into the church then in the 70s and the 80s, and it's now here to stay. But I think that's definitely the case. But one thing that's good to know, however, is that this invasion has happened before. A new state. Miserere nobis. In the 11th century, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis. Okay? So there was what we now call the Renaissance dance rhythms that we get in some of the wonderful dum 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 ti dum dum ti dum 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 ti da da dum ti. Well, That was happening through that time. It happened again in the Baroque era because Palestrina and all those guys, it had gotten very austere, carefully balanced, very classical, and rather intellectual. And then you come along with Monteverdi, wonderful Italians, and they started using the keyboard, and the rhythm started to get more gutsy. The St. Mark School, Gabrielli and those people. Beep-bop-beep-bop. Well, this was a canzona. Ding-dum-dum-dum rhythm. Even the sarabande of Bach, as I mentioned in the other setting, the sarabande is actually a New World dance that was based on the alternation of 2 and 3, which comes from Africa. It went from the New World to Spain, was banned there because of its salacious character, and got slowed down and smoothed out, and 100 years later, Bach was writing them in the cantatas. Okay, so this kind of thing has happened before, but it is often the case that in church music, or I don't know of times that it's not the case, that the revolutions in church music haven't come from the incorporation of folk materials of some kind. Just now it's global, and it's from all over the world. And it makes me, as a musician, think about, well, what would happen after this? I mean, you know, it's like we have the materials of the whole world. Yeah, yeah. At our fingertips. So that's a great question, actually. It gives me a chance to do a lot of that. Anybody else have a question?
It kind of like
the
syncopation, straight to syncopation, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, when you were doing that,
yeah. Yeah, right. But interestingly enough, when we think of syncopation, the way I was taught syncopation was something that was off the beat. You know, it was like, it was a deviation. But what's interesting is that da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-da, this is what they call the rhythmic mode. It was very classical in the sense that it was all organized. It had its name. What is that? I am? I am. Yeah. So they applied those poetic meters to the music. So it was carefully. And the thing is, the same thing is true with the African influence. Once you sense what the underlying pulse is, stuff is going to happen. And what's happened is that a lot of people like me who grew up playing jazz and that sort of thing have now started to write music where we bring those influences in, but we don't necessarily honor the underlying pulse. So it gets to be confusing, and it's often hard, not only for congregations, but for musicians performing or composing. All right, so let's dive in a bit. First of all, the question I think to start out with is, if we have a congregation that is only used to the green book, or whatever color the book is in your denomination, is used only to the sort of traditional hymns, some related to the chorale tradition, a lot of them related to the 19th century revivalist tradition, how do we begin to use materials from Latin America, from the African American tradition? Well, there have been spiritual go down Moses, that sort of thing. And the South African freedom songs are just so wonderful that there are very few churches that I know of that really resist those pieces. Use the South African things in your church. We've had a conversation about what do you do with a congregation that's small, that's rural, that doesn't want to get off of square one very much. And I think that there are some materials which are just so attractive on their face that it's just hard to get upset about them. And so one of the things that I think is important to do, and it's important not just to do over the long haul with a congregation, but also within each individual service, is build bridges between traditional and non or less traditional materials. And there are certain kinds of pieces that I think do that well, and I have to mention those as we get started. I think that pieces from the folk hymn tradition, both, I'm doing everything out of with one voice. You know, actually, could somebody...
You just probably gotten one with one voice. I
think there's some up there, Michelle.
No, like singing my
congregation.
Uh-huh. We stepped that way from with one voice years ago and don't use anything out of any hymn books anymore.
Oh, really?
It's all contemporary. Well, that's contemporary service we also have.
I see. Of a traditional service. Okay, yeah, that's an interesting question, because I'm having been in a couple of of churches where, so you, for you, the question may
well, I've been coming to home, and I've been trying to get, I've been living in California, I'm trying to get people for years.
So good.
Having given up on that, obviously I'm not a good salesperson, I finally said, with one voice, because Marty and my daughter was married by Susan. And
Marty, sure. Well, it's clear we have a wide range here, and I think that's indicative of where the church as a whole is. I find that I have a tough time in the exclusively contemporary service kind of thing. I chose to be an orchestra director because I really love music, and I just every year I want to do music by those people and spend every day at it and learn. So being the local gospel liturgy player, you know, is kind of an odd hat for me to have to wear. Look at number 730. This is an example of a piece that can, I think, function in many different kinds of services well. It would work in your contemporary service. It has a lot of words, so you'd have to be flipping. I don't know if you use the overhead projector, but, you know.
It's all, we put it all into,
print it into a folder. Okay, yeah, that's similar to what we do, although we do use hymnals at our church. I will play this as it's here on the page. By the way, I had to ask Laura, I had to sing this tune to Laura so she could tell me what the hymn tune name is. So let's take it. Williams.
Yes.
Pardon me?
Dynamite
tune. Absolutely. Wonderful. And it is the kind of piece which could support a set of orchestral variations very well. But if you notice, it's a folk tune. It's not one that he made up. And some of his best tunes that he did make up have this character because he was a folk song, you know, as a musicologist and loved collecting these things. All right. So if I'm in a church where guitar playing or rhythm section playing, praise band kind of playing, is the norm. We can do this, which is a wonderful presentation of the Magnificat in inclusive language. It just doesn't make an issue out of, you know, lots of he's and thou's, which when you read it in Luke, you just say, how are we ever in the world going to get rid of all of these, you know, he's and that sort of stuff. But it can be done in a number of different ways. So I'm going to jump ahead of myself a little bit, but just to give you an idea how I might play it in a more contemporary service. I played more notes than were on the page, but one of the important characteristics, and David Freudenberg is the name I was trying to listen to, a fellow who graduated from Valparaiso years ago, not that many years ago, but he gave a speech at the Association of Lutheran Church Musicians Convention when it was held at Valparaiso, about what's called harmonic rhythm. And in it, what he said, I wasn't able to go because I was giving something on Finale, the music program, at the same time, but he would let me read his presentation. And he said that for many congregations, the number of times that chords change in the measure, and this is shifts of harmony, and if you think about Bach, pretty much every note has its own chord. Okay. Sure, I should have picked one that I had in front of me. But you know what I'm talking about. The chords change very fast. And he said a lot of people say, well, I like contemporary music because it's smoother. Well, drum set, guitars, all of those notes, and it's smoother. What he's suggesting is that slowing down the harmony makes the music feel more placid. And that's what I did the second time. I played more notes, but I played less chords. And that's something which it might be hard for you if you're not a musician to describe. But as you're listening to music, I think that's something that's very important. And remember one of my points about being willing to use simpler materials. What I did was not simple, but I simplified the basic materials, the structure of it. And so that's a very valuable thing. And it works well, particularly with folk tunes, because they often are prolongations, as we would say in analytical terms, of one simple. I stayed with E minor almost all the way to the end of the first line.
Okay.
Also, I was using a drone. I kept E in the left hand all the way through. Drones are a very important part of traditional music from all over the world. And we were talking about what to do with the Palestinian, the Arabic hymn that we did a night or two ago. And had we had more time to think about it, you know, maybe we would have used a cello droning on a single note. But that kind of thing is very powerful, again, for getting past the kind of verbal defenses that we all carry around with us all the time and moving into a more meditative place. And that's something that I try to do in the service whenever I play. Different styles of music allow that more than others. But I think it's a very valuable way, and I particularly do it during the Eucharist. And I grew up in the, you know, funeral parlor organ during communion. You know, you had communion once every 6 months, and when you did, the organist had to play tunes that you could barely recognize because it was so small and gluey, you know. So that's the tradition I grew up in, so I like that kind of placid. I also have a theory about things, and it's not something that one can prove, but I think that the rate of change in relates us to thinking about things in a more present-oriented or more timeless-oriented framework. And if there are lots of changes, a lot of things happening, I find that very temporal and very involved in the here and now. And sometimes that's very appropriate. And for one service, I can't remember too much of this, but...
Yeah,
I have a friend who does that and tries it, and he'll have all the old gals on his back. And he was going to do some Easter thing at near Christmas. I don't know when I said when. Never mind what they said. But he is like, would you like to try that kind of. Yeah.
Well, and see, I did that in a service when I was, 25. And it was so sweet because there was a woman from our Bible study who was retired and just a salt of the earth person. And we're talking about it in the Mennonite church now, you know. And she said, Dennis, I had such a hard time singing the alto part that we're doing. And she's being sincere. Well, this is the thing. I mean, knowing her, she could have been setting me up. But she wasn't so musically sophisticated, and my guess is that's what she meant. Whether she did or not, it's such a great thing.
Well, she'd probably been singing the alto part of that song.
She knew it by memory.
And that's the way she sang that song.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't there.
Right. Okay, so that's one thing about harmony to talk about. Let me give you a couple more. Let me give you a couple more kind of specific ideas that again may not be so helpful for you if you're not involved in doing accompaniments. But as you think about different kinds of harmony, I've mentioned drones, I've mentioned harmonic rhythm. there are specific kinds of traditions that use different kinds of harmonies. Folk music tends to use simple chords, three-note chords, major chords, minor chords, all right? Jazz, okay, four-note chords, five-note chords, six-note chords. Gospel, particularly urban gospel, tends to draw its language from jazz. And, you know, it's definitely the case that gospel music, black gospel, grew out of black popular music. I mean, you want to talk about a baptism of materials that you wouldn't really want to know where they came from. That really is the origin of a lot of those kinds of things. And that tends to be fairly complex, and we're going to play a little bit of that. Latin music, some Latin music tends to be more folk-oriented and have simpler chords. A lot of rock music tends to have simpler chords. You've only got six strings on the guitar, and with the amount of distortion and stuff that's used, sometimes they even use chords that are basically just fifths. You know, it's powerful, and it's fun to play. I would never let the people back home know that. But it is, so it tends to be simple. All right, so let's take a minute now. I want to talk a little bit about specific rhythms, and then we'll spend the rest of the time on harmonization. I said to you that I wanted to mention how this rhythmic structure came about. This is something that I have been doing jazz for 30 years before I really came to an understanding. This is so strange to me, but this rhythm is so central. If you divide it up and think about it in Western analytical terms, it divides a 12-beat sequence. And it emphasizes how many pieces in the West? You can't count them. It's not possible. So this I think of as like the major scale of the music of that place. It's like, okay, this is the basic materials. Now what you do to this and with this is what makes it interesting. So when we are bringing African music or Latin music to our home situations, we got people who, oh, I'm a drummer, I would like to play. Well, yeah, that's fine. And it's good to have drums playing, and they should play, and if they play something that goes along with it. But when you begin to learn about how the parts fit together, and more than I know, I mean, I keep thinking I've got to go some summer and really do an intensive in this, so I've got more to say about it. But if you can have two or three people who have carefully defined parts, and then there's just a little bit of improvisation that goes on in relationship to that. But in most African drum ensembles, the improvisation is almost all done by one master drummer. And everybody else listens to that person and may change their rhythm on the basis of what that person plays. But one person is in charge and does the improvisation, and everybody else has a very narrow range. You know,
run in there.
Yeah, so it's much more disciplined. And then one person is going crazy over the top and playing 5 and 7, you know, all of this great stuff. All right, so let's take a look at a couple of specific hymns with these Latin American rhythms. Turn to 791. Now, this is one that was not as automatic to me as some of the others, so I maybe shouldn't have started. But if you look at it, most of these tunes will have a place where there's a dotted rhythm that is emphasized. At the very end of the first line, da, 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 da. So that's where I put my D, da. What I'm playing is quite simple, actually, but the bass line is going to do. Now, I don't know Manuel Jose Alonso or Jose Pagan. Maybe they wouldn't like me playing it that way. Okay? Maybe they want exactly what's on the page. I kind of doubt it. Yeah. But the other thing is that I have to play this in a way that I can understand and that I can make have some life for my congregation. 784. Now this is one where the rhythm, Lake Shore, that to me seems like the strong duple. So Laura, will you play ding, ding, bong, 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 bong,
quarter, 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 rest, quarter, quarter,
ding, ding, rest, bong, bong, ding, ding, bong, bong. Thank you.
same kind of quality?
I could go on about that for days. Take a look at 686. Now, this is one which is not from the Latin American tradition. But I submit to you that part of what gives this chant its magnificent, haunting quality is that very same rhythmic shift. And it's so long from the second beat to the downbeat of the next bar when you do the repeat. And I think that's part of what makes it so wonderful. Laura, let's talk about harmonization a bit. I've asked Laura to play Amazing Grace in a couple of styles, and I will play a couple of other styles.
I thought we were going to run out of time and I get out.
She's watching my wife.
I gave her a list of styles to find out which one she was most comfortable with, and I would give her some suggestions. Because Amazing Grace is one of those. Amazing Grace, you know, you can do it with bagpipes, you can do it with penny whistle, you know, do it with the organ, it works all kinds of ways. So, tell us which styles you felt most.
Let's do a little black gospel.
Okay, a little black gospel.
Although, I have a little trouble figuring out the differences between that and blues, because what I worked on to me after us was so much blues.
Not blues, anything but that heathen
or
godforsaken music.
Yeah, I think you have a hard time distinguishing them. and so that affects what chords we use, okay? And in the blues, we almost always use an added note, a fourth note, but it's a note that's not in the major scale. It's the minor seven. And so what I would do is I would probably take most of the major sevens you play and make them into dominant sevens, okay? So instead of using this sound, I would probably use... It has a kind of visceral tension to it that I think is part and parcel of life in the United States in these dark days. I mean, I just think that there are some things for which that kind of color to the sound, I'm sorry, I hope it's not a racist thing. It has an energy and a passion to it. It is. And that's something that, again, folk music, particularly Celtic folk music, which I like a lot, does not tend to use that chord base so much. Simple triad and not balance, that kind of thing. She was playing with triplets. Dun, 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 dun. That comes from the African tradition. Okay? not the way this tune would have been done originally, back when Joseph Funk collected it in his Virginia, what is it, Virginia?
Is it the Southern Harmony?
Southern Harmony, yeah, it was collected in a couple of books. Let me contrast, Laura, I'm going to move up the piano real quick. Let me contrast this with what I would call a sort of a white gospel, kind of bluegrass-oriented version, which would be duple in its structure, not triple at all, and much more simple chords. Not very much. Simple chords that kind of a two-beat feel. You can hear banjos, dulcimers going, and yeah, all of a sudden Mint Julep is not so far away. You know, it has a kind of a relaxing. Okay, let's have another one. Okay, which one is this?
I don't remember what I did. It was the Latin three-fourths.
Latin three-fourths.
Okay, you were talking about.
But it was a little beyond the Lutheran church norm.
I did Amazing Grace once in the chapel with the electric bass playing an ostinato that moves in and out of F major to F minor. And it had its own contour, its own direction. And it like related to Amazing Grace in kind of oblique ways, you know. Using other materials, I'm going to go through that same using other materials. We're coming up to the end of our time here and getting ready for dinner. Laura also prepared some materials from the Liturgy of Joy, but that's something that she can work on her own since you're not a keyboard player, so I'm not sure if they that is the material. But the thing about it is that the original ports for the Liturgy of Joy were quite straightforward, and James Capers, who wrote it, I'm sure he just tore it up on the piano when he played it. But he was trying to put something down that was simple to play. And so when I did the accompaniments for it, I created the way that I would like to play it. And then I put that on the page. And I'm a composer, that's what I do all the time. It ended up that the materials, I think, are too difficult. And this is something that I was wrestling with during the whole time I was doing it. I was trying to make it a characteristic. But why don't you play just a little bit of the Lamb of God? Well, then people go. Well, don't have to play the whole thing. Maybe play the first Lamb of God. Well, play the original. Yeah. This is a tune where essentially you've got three statements that are actually going on the text. And to me, that just doesn't belong into it. I mean, I'm a communion, and I've got this incredibly expressive tradition, and everybody's there, so what can we do that can get us deeper into this feeling of what this is all about? Probably emphasize the top voice in the fifth and fourth fingers a little bit more and pull back in the middle just a little. And I would also slow it down just a hair, because what I really want to feel why don't you do, have you done the whole thing?
I don't want
to play it. Well, some of the harmonies are a little bit too good. Let me play just the rest of it real quick. Thank you. We're going to pick up at the last one, and we'll go to the end. Thank you.
finished her freshman year.
Wowzers.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Jim Holloway's jazz arrangements?
No, I'm not.
He was a professional at PLU. He was the one who was murdered a year ago. I don't know if you ever heard about that.
Oh, yes.
Or not,
no. He was an artist.
He was, but he was also an incredible jazz artist.
Oh, I had no idea.
Some amazing jazz arrangements, most of which are not written down anywhere.
Right.
But you remind me of him when you play.
Oh,
just like,
really?
Oh, Jesus, Jim. I was at Valparaiso a year ago, taking my youngest son there. He was seriously considering it, and at the last minute, chose PLU.
PLU.
So.
Yeah. Well, our daughter looked at PLU, although she never actually visited. But she thought seriously about it.
Well, big brother's at PLU.
So. Ah.
Much closer to the backyard than Valpo.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you start getting cold feet as we got closer and closer.
No, it's a long ways away, although we do get some people from the West Coast.
It's a great school. Yeah. Very impressed.
I'm pleased to be there.
And your choral conductor's the Choir of the West.
Right.
He directed, I was in Choir of the West when Maurice Skonos was there. And your director did one of our reunion pieces, directed one of our reunion pieces when we were there. He was
enjoyed him. Chris Cox.
Chris Cox.
Let me show you a couple of things.
Yeah.
Real quick. Just a couple of things.
What would you do without her? A
couple of things that I want you to notice about this, because they are so counterintuitive. Like this. Be natural.
That.
You saw what it was. It's contrary lines. This is an imitation of what happens in a jazz band, because the bass player is doing his or her thing, and the keyboard player is doing his or her thing, and those kinds of things happen sort of automatically. But they happen in gospel. Pianists accompany too, and there are some other places that are more obvious than this one.
Another thing here that I had a lot of trouble with is the, because when I'm just plowing through it, trying to get the notes in there, and I know that's important to the thing.
Well, and that is the three. Exactly.
I mean, I'm usually so bored. It's just to get it all in my fingers,
you
and
know,
my ears. And
it's so bizarre, because I tried to simplify. I pulled notes out. I tried to make it as easy as I could.
Some of it is just the reading.
Yeah.
You get to some of these things, you go, okay, now I can't remember what else was already natural.
That's
in the bar,
right.
And then I can just read through it.
Yeah. Right. Well, and the other thing about it, too, is that they didn't want any tenutos, no accents, no dynamics.